I am Plante on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Timothy Taylor joins me again, the best-selling and acclaimed author, has a new book out, The Rule of Stevens. The novel's Catherine Bach survives a plane crash that should not have had any survivors. This obviously shapes her life, and as she resumes a career in the world of biotechnology, she gets a call from another survivor who warns of his life now in ruins, seemingly thanks to his luck running out. Who's responsible? Another person who resembles him. Catherine's own life then starts to unravel, and thanks to someone who she bears an uncanny resemblance to. I'll get Mr. Taylor to tell us more, as well as the Rule of Stevens, which distinguishes the world as run in an orderly, rational world, as seen by Stephen Hawking, or one that allows for the paranormal that one would expect from the work of Stephen King. Timothy Taylor's first novel, Stanley Park, was a bestseller and a finalist for the Giller Prize. His most recent novel, The Blue Light Project, was also a bestseller and the winner of the CBC Bookie Prize. He teaches creative writing at the University of British Columbia. He was last done in 2014 with his book Foodville. There'll be an event with the Vancouver Writers' Fest Insight Series Monday, the 26th of March. This new book is published by Doubleday. Please welcome back to the Plante Online program, Timothy Taylor. Mr. Taylor, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
So I wanted to clarify something that you said in an interview with the Creative Writing Department website at UBC, where you teach. You said that you write novels are not personal. Now, my understanding is from the dedication of the book that this book was born out of personal loss. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, or more accurately, as I got into the last year of writing it, then I just went through a very difficult time, and three people very dear to me passed away in a short period of time. And, you know, the significance of that was that I was writing about a character who was going through very, very troubling times in her life, and she was forced to begin to question a previously, you know, very rational approach that she'd taken to life, because circumstances were forcing her to ask questions like, my goodness, you know, what is going on here? This just doesn't seem right.
Yeah.
And I ended up kind of asking the same questions of myself. So without meaning to, I entered into a kind of a method writing situation where I was living through some of what the character was going through. So I found it, under those circumstances, kind of a very personal process in terms of accessing some of what I imagined to be her torment, you know.
Uh-huh.
I wouldn't normally be in that position with the character, but there I found myself in the middle of 2016 going through something, you know, like that. So.
Yeah. So this was 2016 when you suffered these losses. So you started this book before that, is that correct?
Yeah, it would have been underway for a while, but just every book comes together a little differently, and the interesting editorial detail that some of your readers may be listeners may be interested in is that there was quite a significant first edit that was recommended by my new editor, Martha Kenya Forstner at Doubleday, and she was very wise in recommending it. It involved the removal of a character, but that process was very involved, and so I was working on that through 2016, and as a result of removing this other character, Catherine really stepped up in the book to become the absolute center of our focus.
Yeah.
And so I was really living, you know, living, eating, breathing, and drinking this character. You know, they were my oxygen for the course of the rewrite during 2016. So that made the effect that I was talking about earlier all that much more intense.
So had you, in your previous novels, had you not, say, lived the characters as you did the ones in The Rule of Stevens?
I think it was just a little easier because I don't recall a character being quite as desperately pressured as Catherine is in this book. So for sure, in writing Stanley Park, I did a lot of living that overlapped with Jeremy's because of all my chef Jeremy character, because of how much cooking I was doing at that time and how much I was thinking about cooking. But let me tell you, that was an altogether more pleasant experience. So, you know, living Catherine's existential agony was a good deal more challenging than learning how to cook an omelet the right way.
Well, we'll talk about Catherine in just a sec, but you'll permit me to just pursue this idea that I had as I'm starting the book and thinking about what you've gone through in terms of writing it and these personal losses that I've already mentioned. Does writing provide you, I guess in the midst of loss, some sort of wisdom or comfort maybe?
Yeah, that's a good question, and I wonder if I'm yet far enough past it to really know. I have certainly never previously thought about writing as being part of personal catharsis or anything like that. Mm-hmm. I have that has just not been my overall approach to the work. But you know, maybe you're onto something there. In that, in a few years' time, I'll look back on the process of writing the book as having been part of moving through a grieving process. You know, I mean, the first person to pass away in that short period was my father, and that, you know, my mother passed away 10 years ago. So that, you know, that's a kind of an epic thing that people go through, you know, when the second of two parents passes. And, you know, maybe I'll find as I look back in a few years that the book was part of sort of my passage through that time.
I hate to use this dreadful phrase, but does it help to move on, say?
It might, I guess. I guess what I'm saying is I'm not sure I know yet.
Mm-hmm.
I do feel differently now than I did in 2016. I mean, I'm maybe partly as an exercise of the will. I'm looking at 2018 as being a new year, a year when one can look forward with hope, you know, and so that feels very different than the way I felt midway through 16.
Yeah, you know, I hate to invoke myself in all of this, but 2017 was a pretty shitty year for me. Like, I mean, I'd had about, I think, three or four or five, probably five different people that I knew died last year. And so this is fascinating to me that you're able to, I don't know, come out of it with something like a book like this that I'm imagining a lot of people will be picking up right around now, finding some wisdom in it.
Well, definitely when it comes, now this steps, first of all, I should say, I'm sorry about your losses, that, having been so recently through stuff like that myself, I know all about how that leaves a person feeling, and so I wish you very sincerely, you know, that you'll come to your own, you know, to your own route through these things. They're tough, they're never easy.
Yeah.
If Catherine was one thing that was interesting for me to explore with Catherine was that she ends up in a situation of high conflict where she's at war in a way with another character in the book. And her approach to getting through that, I think, is something she discovers in the moment. She has to draw on certain resources that she didn't know she had. She has to do something that runs very counter to her nature. And this is a difficult book to talk about without spoiling or giving things away,
yeah.
And I don't want to do that. But she does get to a moment of sort of epic confrontation with what can only be understood as kind of a sort of the antagonist of all antagonists in her life. And she's forced to do something that she didn't know she could do, act in a way that's sort of against her best instincts. And that's something I would wish for myself that I could learn from, because it's a way of dialing down conflict at the moment when you think it's out of control.
Yeah.
And you know, so she's an interesting character in that way, that if there was something to be learned, it's something that I hope I can learn. You know, I'm not necessarily sure I'll be successful, but yeah, I think she does something very important at a certain key moment in the book.
So she's in the biotechnology industry. And that's a very, you know, obviously an important sector and one that there's a lot of pressure, I guess, if you're in that field because of just the way, I guess, you know, the demands of medical science and I guess also the demands of making money, I suppose, factor into its work, right?
Yeah, she's doing something that it exists in the world, although I gave her a more sophisticated product than actually exists right now. What she's basically done is she's made an ingestible diagnostic device that has a technology that allows it to moor in the stomach and read, at a very sophisticated level, read body vital signs.
Mm-hmm.
And then these are communicated out to a phone application, and the phone application interfaces with the cloud where experts are available through subscription services. And so a person can have like this. The company's called DIY Agnosis, and that's a very deliberate play on words to signal the taking of one's health care really back and taking control of it oneself, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's what she sells, and there's a lot of excitement around the product. And so if there's pressure created, and there is a lot of pressure created for Catherine. It's because there's so much excitement about what she seems to have been able to do. And a lot of people flood in the form of early subscriptions, basically signing up to be first users of the product when it's finally ready to be beta'd.
Mm-hmm.
And that creates, you know, that's something that happens in real-world markets, you know, that the excitement of a whole crush of people getting enthusiastic about something can cause, you know, a variety of mania, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so investors swarm, you know, and she has a an angel investor who helped her get the thing off the ground at the beginning, and he starts to become impatient with the pace of development, and then eventually an equity, private equity fund takes an interest in her, and the beginnings of a hostile takeover start.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the pressure is created by her own success, but it doesn't make the pressure any easier to handle anyway.
And she had success before this I'm calling a Fitbit sort of thing because that's the only thing I can sort of describe it as. Has she had any previous success in the sector before when we meet her at the start of the book?
She came out of medicine actually.
Mm.
She was a doctor and worked in a clinic on the downtown east side and became interested by one of her colleagues once said, a kind of laconic guy who wasn't particularly interested in technology. He just kind of had this conceptual thought. He said, you know, one microchip installed in a person, I'm actually forgetting exactly his words, but to the effect, mm-hmm. one microchip installed in a person's shoulder and we could prevent 80% of these people with advanced difficulties that they're seeing in the clinic, you know, because basically if you had early warning about some of these things that would be possible if there were ways of monitoring the body on a more ongoing basis. And so she, you know, she doesn't walk out of the clinic that day and start the company, but it kind of sits with her for a while, and she's thinking about it, and she's just thinking, wow, isn't this fascinating, you know, the idea that maybe you could read body vital signs on a more significant level than, say, you know, blood pressure, blood type kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And what tips her over the edge, and she begins to think this is really a potentially interesting idea, is actually the kind of accidental discovery of a technology which does exist today, which is of generating power from within the body. There's a way of combining, I believe it's magnesium and copper, and making use of acids in the body, for example, in the stomach, to actually be a very, very, like, grain of sand-sized battery.
Mm-hmm.
And once she begins to fold together some of what she knows about, you know, very advanced work in diagnostics with this idea that you could have a power source inside the body, and, you know, she begins to piece together a number of components, and it starts to look like a really interesting idea to her.
So when you write a book like The Rule of Stevens, Timothy, do you do a lot of research? Like, I mean, did you talk to people in the biotech sector, and did they tell you this thing is possible, maybe?
Well, critically, I was not necessarily interested in whether it was possible because I wanted her to be working on at the edge, right?
Mm.
So the very first thing that everyone commented, including my doctor brother, who I think I've had a reason to ask my brother, who is a doctor in Alberta, I've had to ask him a question, I think, on every novel I've ever written. something comes up in the world of healthcare or the health condition of one of the characters, and I run it by him. And the very first thing he said is, well, yeah, I mean, in theory, were diagnostics advanced to a certain point, you could have a structure of this kind, but how would you get it to stay in the body?
Yeah.
So I have to completely invent a technology in the book, which becomes part of the narrative, really, is whether or not she can make this work. And it's called hyperlocalized endometrialization, which is essentially the pill that you swallow, which is a very, very small pill, attaches itself to the stomach lining in a fashion not dissimilar to the way that a fertilized egg attaches itself to the uterine wall.
Mm. So is Vancouver, because it plays a part in the book, the book is partially set here, does that, is this town, is Vancouver a leading spot for this industry?
You know, I'm not aware that it is, but I am aware that we have our own little burgeoning tech sector here.
Mm.
And, you know, part of what I wanted to play with in the book is tech sector workplaces. I have done a little bit of writing about that in connection with some work that I've done for business magazines in Canada, BC Business and Report on Business Magazine. And so I've been a little bit interested in tech sector workplaces. And And so I'm aware that, you know, that we do have a small burgeoning tech sector here in Vancouver. So it was not completely out of the realm of possibility that someone would start here. But the bigger question about why Vancouver, you know, it really has to do with something about me drawing on material that's ready at hand. This is a city that I know and I love, and that I sort of identify with very strongly as a result of family history.
Mm-hmm.
And so it just feels, it's always felt very natural for me to put characters here. The only time I think I have not done that is with the Blue Light Project, where I deliberately wanted the city to kind of represent an urban everywhere. But this very much felt like something that could happen in Vancouver.
Well, what if, I don't know if you read the critics or not, but I'm curious to know, what have other people told you about the Vancouver that you write in your books, as opposed to the Vancouver, say, that we all know? I mean, is it the same thing, do you think?
Well, I try. I mean, authors can only, respond to their own subjective sense of things, or that is, you know, we are inexorably drawn in that direction because we're humans. And so I have a subjective impression of Vancouver and a set of experiences that are kind of my Vancouver. And so that's what you get. You get Timothy Taylor's Vancouver when you're reading stories by me that are set here.
And so in a time where we're all talking about the future of the city because it's changing as rapidly as it is,
mm-hmm.
Is your Vancouver, I mean, do you have any feelings as to where we're headed and what that Vancouver might look like, say, 5-10 years down the road?
I don't know. I mean, I'm as aware as the next person of some of the seemingly unsustainable aspects of Vancouver, including an incredible disparity between our real estate prices and our average incomes, you know, and people that are much smarter and more educated in this than me are carrying an ongoing discussion, is going on this topic, and I'm not sure I have a lot to add except that I perceive it to be a risk to Vancouver. I think I have written before about what I perceive to be the real risk of us losing artists out of the city,
mm-hmm.
losing young people. Those are things that cities have to mix. You have to mix in those elements to keep things vibrant and creative and to keep new and exciting things happening. And so I think Vancouver really has to pay attention to that over the next little while. One way that I kept the discussion of real estate out of the novel is I had Catherine be a renter.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a deliberate choice. You know, she's put everything that she has into this company. I wanted her to be a person who's all in. You know, DIY Agnosis is what she's got going on, and
yeah.
So she's not a property owner.
You know, I hate to go back to this point about the personal aspect of your life and whether that's informs your writing, but I mean whether your books are personal or not. But are you anything like Catherine?
Well, there's aspects of Catherine that I would like to. I'd love to be like that. She's very, and let's hope that I am to a degree. She's able to be quite rational in making her decisions, or at least she is until she comes under significant threat because of some strange things that life throws at her. But she's also, she's also really dedicated to task, and she's hardworking, and she's a person of ideas and industry, I do believe in those things, so. I admire her, so I'll take any comparisons.
Does this plane crash that she's a survivor of, does this confront her life on a daily basis?
Yeah, it does, actually. And one of the areas that I did research a bit on is the psychological reality of survivor's guilt and what confronts people when they go through something like that. For her, she has a kind of a suite of psychological issues that stem from the crash, including recurring dreams that are very uncomfortable and a sense of the world having behaved sort of inappropriately in her favor, such that she has exhausted all her luck in one go, in order to have survived that crash, because it was a pretty epic disaster, and multiple hundreds of people were killed, and only six people survived, so...
How do you view life after writing a book like this? I mean, in terms of luck and chance and circumstance, someone in the book talks to Catherine about his own luck seemingly have run out, seemingly has run out. I don't know. Do people actually look at their life like that? I mean, maybe I'm just fortunate enough, myself or the people around me, that it's just a cycle. You know, that good stuff happens and bad stuff as well, and then you know, you just continue again, right?
I think that's exactly the kind of rational position that one takes on life and fate and luck and all those things. You see, you know, when you're feeling secure enough to be that rational, then that is exactly where we take refuge, you know, is that, yeah, these things go in cycles and that there's probably some long balancing effect and that, you know, people aren't really intrinsically lucky or unlucky, you know. And so, yes, that's a very familiar line of thinking to me as well. When it tends to be challenged is when things really skew hard one way or the other.
Mm.
And then I think, you know, people do become subject occasionally to this feeling that the scales are not balancing correctly, and that's very much what Catherine goes through.
And this is, I guess, a good place to talk about the title of the book, The Rule of Stevens. Did you come up with that yourself?
Yes, I'm very proud of myself. I came up with that all by myself. One of the very original ideas of the book was this idea of a person who was once so lucky, benefited so greatly from quote-unquote luck, that they begin to wonder if they've used it all up. That was one of the very original ideas of the book. And so that then quickly raised the idea of, you know, whether we live the world in a way that essentially depends on rationalism or whether we kind of think that there are more mystical forces at work.
Yeah.
And so Stephen Hawking versus Stephen King became the slightly tongue-in-cheek axiom that I wrote for the purpose. And it's actually something that Catherine said as a young person to her sister. Her sister was a bit more of a romantic, and so Catherine would say to her, listen, it's the rule of Stevens. You know, the world either works according to the cosmology of Stephen Hawking, or it provides for the aberrations of the paranormal as per the universe of Stephen King. But you have to choose. You can't live in both.
But I guess from personal circumstance, I mean, we do go back and forth, don't we? That line is very thin sometimes.
Oh, yeah. In fact, a lot of what we enjoy most in life lives right in the blurry zone between, right?
Yeah.
I mean, there's not always tragic examples either, right? Like, yeah, for sure, the loss of a loved one can feel, and if you lose if you go through the misfortune of losing a few people, you know, you start to think, my gosh, this just doesn't feel like science. This feels like I'm being, you know, that the world is coming down on me. But good things too, you know. I mean, love, I tend to think, falls into this slightly blurry category. I mean, I'm sure there are scientific ways to explain it, and you know, cell structures and amino acids that could be cited, and evolutionary imperatives, and all of these things. But it's not typically how we think about love when it happens to us. You know, in the midst of the actual experience of love, we tend to think of it as this mystical, uncaused cause. You know, this thing that comes into the world without anything having happened to sort of make it happen. It just kind of was born spontaneously. So in the way that we experience things, I think we very frequently resort to the blurry zone. And so it's a big part of what it means to be human, I think.
But back to the Vancouver that we're all experiencing, you teach at UBC in the creative writing department, and so, I mean, you're with a group of people who are artists, essentially. And so, I mean, the anxieties of living here and being able to stay here, I mean, I'm assuming that for the people that you teach, they feel that acutely.
You know, students do belong to that group of that vulnerable population in Vancouver generally, because they have to rent typically if they don't have handy parents or relations or to live with. So students are part of one of the populations in Vancouver that we have to aggressively protect. We have to make it possible for people to come here and study. And, you know, that's because students are a crucial part of any urban ecosphere, is my position. They do things that other people don't do and make certain things possible in a city that wouldn't otherwise be possible. Students are a very important population.
Yeah, and so what do they tell you about how they see their future?
Well, I mean, only that you hear anecdotally from time to time. I mean, these aren't conversations that come up all the time. Where one of the happy things about being in a creative writing program is you're all happily distracted by writing, and so, you know, to some extent, maybe you can set aside the prosaic concerns of surviving in the city. But when the topic does come up, then yeah, you'll hear from people about someone who's had to change the place where they've rented, you know, three times, and over the course of a term, you know, that kind of thing. You realize, wow, there's a lot of disruption inherent in being a renter, and so you do hear that from time to time.
Well, when you encounter, say, strangers or just people from time to time, and they find out that you work where you work, I mean, I'm assuming in the last couple of years you've gotten a lot of questions about where you work and what that's all about. What's that been like?
You might be surprised. I mean, I think people, when people find out what I do, people have preloaded ideas about what it means to be a prof, and I get some of that stuff, and I'm always happy to talk about it because I feel very lucky to have landed there, and so yeah, you know, there's a certain natural interest in academia on the part of people who haven't been in it. Just it's a bit mysterious how it works and what it's like to be there. So,
but have they had, let's say, preconceived notions as to what's happened there the last couple of years, especially?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. That's just not something I talk about with people. I don't. It's not a good idea.
Do you encounter people, though, that I love this thing, you know, when you go to theater or you go to movie screenings and or even book signings, and there's a Q&A portion, and invariably someone always comes up, not with a question, but with a statement. And so do you get a lot of those?
I haven't. No, I've been lucky. I mean, this is a book is what puts someone in my position out into the public sphere, and mine's only just come out, so ask me in 6 months.
Sure. Your writing has been described as muscular prose, and I see that from time to time for certain writers, and I'm always wondering what the writer makes of that.
Yeah, it's a good one. What do I think? I think it's code for unapologetically narrative. There is a false dichotomy, potentially false dichotomy between writing that sort of exerts itself narratively. So this happened and then this happened, and you know what I mean? Like there's a progression of events and characters bound up in action, doing things, going places, wanting things. it may be a false dichotomy, but between that on the one hand and lyricism, language-driven, potentially more poetic to the ear, writing that moves in that direction. So when a person uses muscular, it's my suspicion that they are referring to your position on that notional spectrum towards the narrative end.
Yeah, I mean, I can't remember a female writer writing described like that.
Well, that's another thing that might be going on, is an implied kind of gendering of the writing, that if it's muscular, then, you know, that it's sort of mesomorphic or something. I'm speculating. I don't really know. I'll have to one day meet a reviewer who used that term.
I have to ask you about food. Any good restaurants that you've been to in this town lately?
Oh, that's a surprisingly hard question for me. I haven't been reviewing in a while, but it's not new, but the restaurant Annalena is spectacular, and people are also raving about Savio Lupo, where I haven't gone, but I've looked at the menu, and it does really look like a menu I would enjoy.
Yeah, it's close to where I live, and it's busy all the time.
Like, it's hard to get in, right?
Yeah, like, it is.
I've thought of it a couple times and been unable to organize it. So
yeah, but people say the food's very good. I've heard different things on service, but generally the experience has been quite good. The times that I've been there, the two or three times, has been absolutely excellent.
Yeah, okay. Well, then I'll try again at some point.
Yeah, this has been fun talking again. I wish you great success with this book. It's one that, I've started, and I'm enjoying a great deal. I don't know if enjoying is the right word, but it's made me think a lot, and it's been a great comfort the last little bit since I've started it. So I appreciate your time today. Thanks for this.
Okay, it was a real pleasure to chat.
The Rule of Stevens is published by Doubleday. Timothy Taylor, its author, joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.